for tuning in to the Javier Morquecho Show. Learn how to start, grow, and scale your business. I'm Javier, and I interview entrepreneurs, corporate executives, and thought leaders, and share their story on my website at javiermorquecho.com. We're joined by Chris Streeter, an entrepreneur from Sonoma County, a co-founder and owner of Senses Wines, one of the most exciting wineries coming out of Sonoma. He's also the co-founder and owner of Duchess Oakland. It's a popular Rock Ridge restaurant and is a hotbed for youthful industry talent. And not just that, he also has his sights set on working towards technology, alternative energy, and space. Hi, Chris. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Looking forward to talking with you.
Yeah. So my goal today is to share your story and talk about your journey of starting, growing, and scaling your business. But first, I want to talk about the power of building a brand. So what would you say is the biggest challenge of creating a brand?
Oh, man, it's a big question, as I'm sure you understand. And it's a great place to start, because out of everything that I've done and all the experience with the winery and the restaurant, the biggest lesson has been, without question, the power of the brand. And it's creating something that survives outside of just who you are as a founder, or who you are, who the group is as founders. And the power of the brand is what drives everything. It drives the word of mouth. It gets, you know, it creates an emotion that people can associate with, that they can count on, whether it's drinking a bottle of Senses wines, or whether it's going to the restaurant and having a meal. I realized that building the brand is the number one priority, because once, and it takes a lot of effort to do that, but as you build the brand, you are creating something that's self-sustainable. So a startup, you know, whether it's a traditional one with wine or food, or, you know, a modern one with technology, everything in the beginning is all about building that brand. So, you know, for most companies, that's product first. That's focusing on making sure you have the best product to share with people. And that takes a long time. But once you get it, then you need to start marketing it and getting the word out about it. And then you need to start selling it. So it's a product, marketing, sales, all in unison. And you have to focus on them equally in order to reinvest in the business and to grow it, all while, you know, building the brand. And this is what creates the word of mouth. For some companies, it takes a lot longer. For the winery, we started in 2011. I feel like we didn't really get the word out and on a self-sustaining path until about 2014, 2015. The restaurant is happening a lot quicker. It's been less than a year. It's happening. I'm very impatient. But the power of the brand is everything, because if you build a good brand, people will talk about it, they'll tell their friends, and then it will all be reinvested and you can scale from there.
Yeah. So what do you think makes a strong or a good brand?
Oh, without doubt, it starts with product quality. You have to have one of the best products out there. And that doesn't have to be the most luxurious wine, the most luxurious, you know, dining experience, or the best app or whatnot. It has to be the best it can be at that value, at that price. And if you can deliver that value, that is everything. And it starts there. But beyond that, you have to be able to market it and sell it. So I feel all branding comes back down to product. And if product quality is missing, then it's an empty brand. And that's going to eventually catch up to it, and it won't be sustainable in the long term.
Yeah, you mentioned that it's very important to have a good quality product. So let's say you do have a good quality product, but you did say that getting the word out and marketing is not, at least you said the first year for your Senses wines, you didn't get the word out. So how important is it to get the word out, and how do you get the word out for a product that is really good?
It's a great question, and there's no right answer here. So I'm just using my examples, because I obviously can speak to the experience. But product quality for Senses took us 3 years to figure out. 11, we made 100 cases. 12, we made about 700. 13, we passed 1,000 cases. It wasn't until 13, so it's 3 years of making wine, that we learned enough about the vineyards, how to farm it, you know, who to work with from a winemaking perspective, and how to, you know, put it in bottle. That's how long it took us to figure out product. And, you know, getting the word out, there was only so much we could do in the beginning. It was just us. It was telling friends, family. That was probably in 2012. In 2013, it was starting to tell the industry about us. And then 14 is when we released the 13s, which as I mentioned, was what I considered our you know, best product yet. And that was when we can start getting attention of press, start getting attention of critics, start getting attention of high-end restaurants, start getting, you know, that feedback and that kind of that word of mouth process working, which just created a bit more sustainability for the brand. And it was everything. It was literally calling all our friends, calling friends of friends, asking for all the introductions you could. For us, our primary marketing vessel was wholesale, getting into the best restaurants. So the French Laundry picked up Census in 2014. And that was a moment when we realized, okay, like this is where we need to go. This is where the brand has evolved to. And this is us playing massive, massive catch up to how quickly the brand is evolving. And I think those moments are what really kind of reinforce the idea of, oh my God, this is why we spent so long getting the product right. This is why it's finally time to tell everybody about it. But yeah, it really depends. You know, on the other side with the restaurant, it was all through, you know, media reviewers coming in to dine and then writing about it. It was people telling their friends. It was a little bit of help from a PR team. It was college networking, alumni. It was everything. And I wish there was an easier way. Although also I'm forgetting one of the biggest sources for us, it's social media. So for Census, we went from, you know, a couple thousand followers to, I mean, now we're like 37,000 or something ridiculous on Instagram, but that was all organic in the beginning. And then it was people telling their friends about us. It was industry seeing us and telling other people about us, or us engaging with people. And that created a more self-sustaining digital word of mouth process, which we absolutely focused on because it was something we could control that didn't cost us a ton of money, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And so you said the first few years, it was mostly reaching out to friends, family, and your own networks. What advice would you give to someone who's still in that stage of their business where they haven't gotten press, they haven't really gotten any social media mentions, and their followings are still growing? In the early stages, what best advice would you give to someone to help grow their business and build their brand if they haven't gotten any kind of publicity yet?
Yeah, it's just funny because, like, thinking back on it, there's no right thing to do except every single thing that you can. And, you know, it wouldn't have made sense in the beginning to focus on sending, you know, notes to high-end press or sending notes to the high-end restaurants. Like, in the beginning, you have to get on a sustainable path, and you get on that through the people who are looking for what's next, the early adopters. Now, there's the early adopters from a consumer standpoint, and this is all documented, and it's a great reference, but the book Crossing the Chasm, forget who wrote it, but just that first chapter is great enough because it gets you thinking, like, oh my gosh, early adopters are everything. Get them hooked on it. There's always somebody out there looking for what's next. What we found was the wine enthusiasts were the ones from a consumer standpoint. For the restaurants, it was just, you know, the people that we had connections to, as well as some high-end restaurants once they learned about the quality of the product. And then for press, it was really press. We just had to really network through our own social circles, through people we've worked with, and through connections with the families, like whatever. There was no easy way. I would just say it was just pounding the pavement and getting out there and showing up every single day. That's what got it out there. That's what got the word out, because we took no financing. So for us, we were bootstrapped, and that created a situation where we had to do everything by ourselves. And it was just relentless storytelling. And that eventually opened the doors to other avenues. And I'd say I tried everything. The team, we racked our brains on everything. Like, I even thought about growth hacking, you know, like a PR list and scraping all these websites for all the writers out there. I never did it because it seemed a little aggressive. Because before you have any credibility, if you go after these sources that report on, you know, some of the top wineries or top whatever companies in your industry, I mean, you're not going to get any time of day from them. So you have to build up credibility. And you build up credibility by having a great product. So once again, going back to product. And then two, just getting a base. For us, it was so simple as getting a couple bloggers to write about us and featuring us as a top 10 winery. Like, that was pretty early on before we knew what was going, what we were doing, what was happening with the brand. But all that created a critical mass. And I think that's the trick. You need to get through the early adopters and find whomever else you can to kind of break through.
And you were referencing Senses Wines and this experience through Senses Wine. I think you mentioned that Duchess Oakland went a little bit faster, but did you experience this same kind of pounding the pavement and a really struggle of growth for Duchess that you did for Senses?
It's so different because Senses is a virtual brand and always or has always started out as a virtual brand. We have vineyards, we don't have like a tasting room, so no one knows about us unless someone told you about Senses. So that's got power in itself, but it also makes it very difficult to get the word out. On the other hand, Duchess is a restaurant. There's a retail establishment. People walk by it every day. People want to go eat, they want to drink. Like, obviously, we're open for business. So every person that comes in, that's like we didn't really technically have to do anything to get people because they're already seeing us. And I think that changes the equation a little bit. It still doesn't just make it happen overnight. So with Duchess, we had to go around, give postcards that announce our opening to everybody in the neighborhood, to promote ourselves within community-specific events, to get the word out to, like the Chronicle or Eater or all these other industry-facing blogs. And I think, even 9 months into it, we are still pounding the pavement in the sense of finding every opportunity we can to share our story and share who we are and make sure that the experience that we create at Duchess is something that A, people want to see, and B, that they are willing to come out and tell their friends about. And I don't think that goes away. I imagine brands that make it to a point where this idea of self-promotion goes away because they don't have to do it from a sales standpoint. Like you become an industry leader and like you're comfortable, et cetera. You're a leader, whether you have pricing power, whatever. Like at some point, a company probably gets there. But in that process, if you ever stop giving up on this like self-promotion and getting the word out and trying to make yourself better every single day as a company, then I think the only way to go is you're gonna lose market strength. And I think no matter what anyone says, you have to do this every single day. So Duchess, it happened a lot faster. Sure, the first month we were packed and slammed. There's a lot of anticipation for a restaurant opening. The following months after the opening, we obviously didn't see the exact same demand. But then it starts to pick up again. There's a lot of seasonality effects. There's a lot of, I think the funniest thing with the restaurant is knowing, wow, like, oh, tax season's here because no one's going out. Or yes, there was a election and everyone's mood was down and they didn't want to go out. Or oh my God, ski week, everyone's gone on vacation. Like you have such a pulse on the local economy and what the community is doing. And there are just so many unknowns, and I've stopped worrying about how to, what caused a great week or what caused a poor week. And instead I just realized as long as we're doing our best and doing everything we can to get the word out, we are on the right path.
Okay, and you did mention the importance of sharing your story and of doing self-promotion. So for someone who hasn't started sharing their story yet, what first steps should someone take to identify what their story is? And once you do it, or once you do know your story, let's say someone is shy, for example, and they don't want to self-promote, how can they get over the hurdle of the fear of telling their story?
It's going to sound silly, but it comes back to passion, which why are you doing what you do? Let's say you start a company making trash cans. Like I don't know, like that's not something I'm really passionate or excited about, except it's helping make the world a better place. You're making sure that people can clean up trash better, whatever. Maybe it's more durable and they don't get stolen. I don't know what the value add is of why someone would want to make trash cans, but if that's what you want to do, you obviously consciously decided that there's a reason that you're doing that. Whether you're passionate about the fact that your idea can add value to people, or you're passionate about, saving the planet, or passionate about just cleaning up the streets, whatever it might be, that passion, you have to share that. And it comes out in whatever form it comes out in, but the genuine passion and just sincerity and authenticity, that's how you promote. It's not just like, oh, hey, we have the best wine in the world, or hey, we have the best trash cans in the world. you'd be surprised. People don't really care so much about that stuff. I mean, yes, there are egotistical buyers or people who are focused on having the best or the best experience or the best product, whatever it might be, or the most money, whatever. But that's not what sells, in my opinion. What sells is people connecting with the philosophy. So promotion and pitching and getting the story out is all about sharing that philosophy and that passion. And that's how we did it. I never realized I was selling anything. I just was so excited about making wine or so excited about opening a restaurant. And for me, my passion is overcoming challenges. So for wine or food, whatever it might be, like, I didn't know anything about a winery beforehand. Sure, I worked at, you know, a large winery for a couple of years and learned some stuff in school, but I didn't know anything about growing grapes or making wine. But I was excited to learn. Same thing with a restaurant. I didn't know anything about making food, but I was super excited to learn and learn how to manage people, how to manage an investor, and to build like a retail business. So my passion is in that process, and I share that with people, and they just get so enthusiastic. It's contagious. When you're excited about something, people get excited about it.
Yeah. For someone who does have a passion, but they do feel shy to tell their story to others, what advice would you give to overcome that fear?
We're all shy to some degree, in my opinion. Like I know myself, like I'm pretty shy at times, I find I'm most shy in new situations, like walking into a crowd, you know, the people I don't know and having to introduce myself and get to, you know, network, if you will. I hate the idea of networking for the sake of networking. I think what I've done is I look at it as like I'm making friends and I want to help people. I want to learn from them and I want to share my story. So if someone's shy and they don't know where to start, you know, you have to kind of just boil back to basics. Like, who do you know in this industry that you're working in? Like, why are you interested in it? Who do you know in this industry? And just like pick their brains. Like, what did they do? How did they get started? Like, who did they talk to? Who did they get in front of? Because the more and more confidence that you develop in the product that you're creating or the service that you're providing, the more likely you are to just get out of your shell and share that story. And I think it's practice. It's just getting out there. In this industry, they joke and say like half the battle is just showing up for sales or whatever it might be. And I believe that to be 100% true of many different things. But in this specific case about sharing a story or promoting or, you know, giving a talk, whatever it might be, just showing up and practicing over and over. And you're going to have tough experiences. I can promise you, I've been in many circumstances where I had, you know, no idea what I was saying or I felt uncomfortable and it just seemed so silly, but who cares? Like, I showed up and I talked to him and I made a contact. And I think that's how I did it.
So at what point do you switch from or make the conversion from sharing your story to selling your product?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think this is something I still go back and forth on so much because I don't want to go into a situation with the goal of just selling. Like, I go into situations at like a personal level, and this is a weird balance that I think I've somehow tapped into. It's the professional and the personal life, right? Like, I blend business with friendships is I think what someone wrote once, but it's true. And I think friendship is number one. Like, that's my priority. And if I'm looking to make a business deal, i.e. I'm pouring wine for a restaurant that I really want to sell it to, I let them know that I'm excited about, you know, meeting them, pouring the wine, and the day that, you know, I actually pour the wine for them and talk to them and we discuss it, you know, you let them know exactly how you feel. So just being clear with the communication and that you want to share it. And you have to realize, like, you can't be pushy. You can't force anything. So the more that you're patiently impatient, this is my favorite way of describing myself, patiently impatient. You're patient enough to kind of let it organically happen, because if you do it organically, you're almost always likely to have a better longer term outcome. But you're impatient because you want to get into all these spots. So your impatience gives you like that hustler attitude where I'm going to show up to as many restaurants as I can and sell this. That's the most important part. You have to show up and you have to just go for it. And then you have to be patient once you do the hard work to see the results. And you just have to, you have to navigate that, and you have to have a very clear mindset on cost benefit analysis. In the beginning, I spent way too much time, and that was my cost, of trying to convert certain tasting appointments or business deals. And over time, I realized, look, you don't have to win them all. You want to work with the people who want to work with you. If you really work hard to work with someone who doesn't want to work with you, hey, maybe you get, you know, a sale today, but there's no long-term benefit from that. So find the ones that want to work with you. There's I think it's a humbling experience, but when you realize that there's so much opportunity out there, there are so many restaurants, there are so many wineries, there's so many, you know, bars, whatever, like you can't work with them all unless you're a huge company. But if you're starting out, you're not covering all the ground. So keep in mind that there are so many others out there that you can go to, and you're guaranteed to find other people who are excited to work with you. So I think that's really the process that I would recommend.
Yeah, and you mentioned that you mix your personal with your business. So if you can just go through and say, what is your story? And you can say, what is your personal story and your personal mission, as well as what is the story of Senses and what is the story of Duchess?
Yeah, once again, big questions, right? So my story, so I'm 29, right? I'm a baby, which I always joke and say, but I grew up in Sonoma County, and Sonoma County is this great area. It's about an hour and a half north of San Francisco, and it's a food county. It's a growers county. It's a wine county. It's a beer county. Like people, it's lifestyle driven, and there's a lot of food, wine, beer, you name it, even some technology there now. And I grew up playing out in the woods every day. Like I played hide and seek, I built forts. Like I loved the outdoors, and that passion for the outdoors, for even math at a young age. I loved math just because it was orderly and clean. So combining those two things together, I was super into science. And I think that's what led me to focus on astronomy. I loved astronomy from middle school all the way through high school, even to today. And I think that's what drove me to apply to a lot of technical colleges. And it landed at Harvey Mudd almost as a coincidence, or it wasn't, I guess it was meant to be, if you want to say it like that, because I was ready to go to Berkeley and I was pending on Stanford and Harvey Mudd. And last minute, I decided to go to Harvey Mudd without knowing anything about the campus. And, you know, I knew it was a leading technical school for engineering and science. And I just went there on a whim. And I think Harvey Mudd was by far you could almost point to it as like one of the single things that completely changed my life. I learned so much about, you know, well, professionally, I learned how to develop like writing skills and obviously a lot of academics, but I just learned how hard the world is and how much teamwork and your relationships matter. And there's no way I could have made it through Harvey Mudd without leaning on the support of all my friends and people in my courses. And at Harvey Mudd, that was when I started to work as an intern at a winery in Sonoma County called Jackson Family Wines. They produce Kendall Jackson, which is probably one of the top 10 largest wineries in the entire world. And it wasn't just working there that gave me this desire to get into wine. It was the fact that I had a mentor. I worked with Jess Jackson. He was the founder there. And he was the entrepreneur who started the company. And it was like 20, 30 years before I joined. And there was just such like a excitement, an enthusiasm, a passion for business from him. And it wasn't just wine or this. I mean, he raced horses and, you know, he's done a lot of things in his career. And I think I realized like, oh my gosh, like you can make the world a better place by starting a business, and you can have such a significant impact on the community, and you could do so much versus in my mind, just becoming, I thought at the time, like a scientist, I'd be trapped in like a lab, and that scared me. And I think I gravitated towards business through my experience with Jess, and I fell in love with the idea of like starting a business. And so I went to school, I continued with a master's in finance. I actually switched my degrees at Mudd from physics to math econ, and I minored in physics, and then I went on and got a master's in finance. And during that year of getting a master's in finance, I realized that, hey, like I'm writing a term paper for an entrepreneurial finance course. Like, oh my God, like I learned what, you know, being an entrepreneur was like. And that's when I had to either decide to write a term paper or a business model or a business plan. Like, why not write a business plan? I called my buddy that I grew up with. His family had a small 2-acre vineyard. It's like, Miles, what if we wrote a business plan pretending that we were going to take over the vineyard, learn how to grow grapes, make some wine. And that day set off, you know, the dominoes for starting a winery. We did all the research, put together the business plan. Actually, I was chosen as the most likely to execute the business plan at the end of the semester, which was exciting. And I decided to skip all finance careers and go back home to Occidental, where I grew up, and to work at a local winery, to sell wine at the tasting room, and to harvest grapes and to make wine in the cellar that fall. Got paid $12 an hour. It was a total mind trip. But what I realized is, oh my God, this is so much fun. And that's when I partnered with Miles and Max. We started Senses, and we basically did everything from scratch there forward. Put up some money, made 100 cases of wine. The following year, we took over the vineyard. We took classes how to learn how to grow the grapes, made, you know, actually literally farm the grapes night at night after taking the classes, and then made, you know, a lot more wine. And year over year, we added so much more to the business. We partnered with a celebrity winemaker. We added some of the best vineyards in all of California for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. And we've grown organically to about 3,000 or 4,000 cases. And this was all through just sweat, tears, and selling enough product to pay the bills, because we took no outside financing. And I think what really did it was just like, I was so excited to learn how to start a business. And Senses was a perfect example of how to learn marketing. And I've learned so much about marketing that I don't think you could really learn in school, because you don't have a concept of a brand until you go through it and you see the strength of a brand. And the most enlightening, I guess, experience of them all was when I was working my way throughout the industry while starting Senses. I always had a full-time job, and I worked in all different facets. So I did harvest, I did sales at a tasting room, I worked at an inventory center, I did, you know, I was a business manager at one of the top wineries, and then I did wholesale sales. And all of this, I learned things and I deposited back into Senses and with the team. And that's how we were able to grow in my opinion, so quickly and so efficiently without having to raise a ton of money. And it was so cool to see how strong these other brands were. One in particular, William Saliam. They've been around for 30 plus years, and they're probably considered the number one direct-to-consumer brand in all Sonoma County. You know, these guys ship in a crazy amount of wine direct to consumers, and they don't have to worry about wholesale or distribution. That's a luxury. And obviously, you know, buzzword in this day and age is direct-to-consumer, but they've been doing that for 20 plus years. And learning that so much of their value was derived from the goodwill of the brand, that kind of like, I had to digest it for a long time. It took me at least a year. And then, you know, putting that into Senses and learning Senses doesn't have to be like a KJ or a large winery, because my idea was like 500,000 cases to a couple million cases. But that's aggressive. When you have some of the best vineyards in the world and you're working with one of the best winemakers in the world, there's no reason to do anything except make some of the best wines. But I realized we could do it while delivering value, underprice our wines compared to our competition, and then also leverage social media, because we're three young guys. We started this when we were 22. Get the word out through social media, so be approachable, and build the brand through that. And be sure to not ever put the cart before the horse, and to grow slowly, because the slower you grow, I know it sounds kind of like paradoxical, but the slower you grow, i.e. like you're not forcing the growth, the more organic it is and the more sustainable it is. So that's everything with Senses. And then with Duchess, I eventually, that's probably back in 2015, I can't remember, I met girl Carolyn, good friend, and you know, I was sharing Senses with her, selling her Senses. I mean, this is going back to sales. Like, I showed up in San Francisco, poured wine, met her. It's like, oh my God, like, you know, cool girl back in San Francisco after being in London for a long time, loved the wines. She was, you know, like a week back in the city from being in London for like 4 or 5 years, hung out. We joked about opening a wine bar because, hey, why not just open a wine bar on the side? It seemed like something I could do in my nights and weekends. And that conversation quickly developed, and she blames me, you know, for creating this, the whole idea of Duchess. But it was definitely a joint effort. But we start like mapping out, oh my God, like here's a GM, I've got a friend, like let's talk to him. Let's figure out what's realistic and like what we could really do. That led to like, oh my gosh, let's look at places to pick up and to like actually build something on. And then it was like, let's run the numbers. Next thing you know, we're going to an escrow, we found a spot, And then, you know, we eventually commit to something and we decide to build Duchess, and it becomes a whole restaurant. And that's a much bigger opportunity than or business than we ever thought we would do. So that's, I mean, it's a lot. I could talk a lot about this, but Duchess was something that kind of came out of nowhere. And now, and I saw it as a perfect opportunity to do food and beverage and to really learn what it took to do a retail business and manage an operation that required 20 or 30 people and a decent amount of investment. So it was another big challenge that I could tackle.
Yeah. And so you did mention social media, and that what that played a part in your early growth. So what do you do on social media, and what do you feel helped grow it? Because I think each of your accounts is over 10,000 or over 20,000 followers. So what did you do to grow it, and what kind of return or what kind of benefit do you see for a business owner to even place effort on social media?
It's, trust me, I get asked this so much by other business owners primarily. They always wonder, is it worth doing anything on social media? And I always say yes. I think just to give you like a little insight for census, we don't have any real presence anywhere because we don't have a retail business. A majority of our signups for our mailing list come through social media and, of course, through people hearing about us through their friends or restaurant accounts or whatever it might be, word of mouth. But I look at social media as digital word of mouth, so it's the same thing. Social media, the real trick to it is just like being authentic, like share photos and stories of who you are and why you're doing what you're doing. Yes, you need to use the right hashtags. I mean, if you could do some basic research and find the right hashtags, you're allowed 30 per post on Instagram. Make sure you're using at least 30, like maximize that. That's free visibility. For me, I think in the beginning, it was just making sure our story was honed in. We wanted to share photos. It's like, what was the point behind the scenes, what we're doing, you know, where we're going, what we're doing as a brand. That quickly evolved into leveraging hashtags. That quickly evolved into interacting with influencers, tagging people who are influencers in your industry, not just critics or companies, but the people who are very active in the social verse, get on their radar and interact with them. And then, you know, I think the most one of the more important things is just make sure you're engaging with your audience and that you're somehow connecting with them, short of just posting a photo and so on. So I think for census, you know, it was a long process, but the more time and effort we put into it, and I'd say the hardest part was just figuring out who your peers are, where your fans are potentially hanging out, and then who are the leaders in the industry from a social media verse and from like a critic verse, and focusing on those players in order to get your presence out there. Same thing with Duchess, exact same thing, except now we're talking about something that's localized. I have like a physical space. I'm in, you know, I'm at 5422 College Avenue in Oakland. Like that means that I can kind of tap into my neighborhood, find all the local businesses, interact with their customers, you know, tag them, see people who are checking into places nearby, reach out to them, invite them in. So there's a lot of, you have to put in a lot of effort into, you know, bringing people back to you, but I guarantee you there is a return to that. There's a lot, even just last night, I got a couple of notifications that people were at the restaurant. It was our best night of the entire year. I'm not even kidding. Best night. It was pretty exciting. We had the most reservations ever. Upstairs, downstairs, completely packed. But I got a couple like photos on Instagram saying, oh my God, blah, 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 you know, talking about the cocktail, or oh, blah, 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 talking about the food. I'm like, that's perfect. And, you know, I just reposted one, I think today. But like that process is what creates a community. Personally, I try to do a lot of stories on my account. I just try to share behind the scenes, like what's going on. It gives people insight into your day-to-day life that they normally perhaps can't see. And that's, I think, the secret. Share with people, show them that you're authentic, show that you're genuine, and show them that you care. We respond to every single comment and we respond to every single message. Now that's a lot of work, but I'm telling you, like, we've never raised money. Like, this is just something that we've done out of passion and out of care, and the results kind of prove themselves over time.
And so you said that you do spend a good amount of time. Just real quick, about how much time do you spend on social media?
It really varies week by week. I'd say, I don't know. That's a hard question. I say for census, we probably post a couple times a week. And so it's a matter of just having the right photos. For Duchess, it's 1 to 2 times a week, just depending on the week. And then for me personally, it's probably like once a week, but I'm posting to the story a lot. How much time? That's a really hard question. I'd say for the actual posting process, it's more, like 30 minutes to an hour a week, or maybe a little bit more. For engagement, that's definitely, you need to throw in like, it's not like you have to do half an hour a day, but you throw in a small block of time as many days during the week as you can, it will make a difference. So I'd probably say 30-ish minutes on average. And then it can increase if you get kind of trapped in a rabbit hole and you just want to go all in on something. So there's a lot of variability, but it's a matter of just seeing what works the best and then focusing on that.
Okay. And so as a business owner, your time could be spent in a lot of different areas. How do you manage your time running two separate businesses, and how do you organize your week or prioritize your days? I know you had told me that each day you do something separate or each something differently. So, how do you manage your time?
I feel like this is a constantly evolving process, and I'm trying to think. In the beginning, I had no idea what to do except just to manage my time through the inbox. That got pretty stressful. I'm thinking through 2000, well, having a day job and running Senses was pretty tricky. I would manage all my workflow through email. And I think it was probably 2014 when I realized that I just having a zero inbox wasn't really working out for me. I never had the time to clear everything. And I always held on to these things that I didn't get to, and it was just kind of overwhelming me and dragging me down. So I think it was 2015 when I came up with a new process of really kind of focusing on what was most important. I did go, actually, I take that back. I never did zero inbox before, and then I moved to zero inbox. Zero inbox has made sure that I get everything done. And I've been religious about kind of setting up daily, weekly, monthly, and quarterly processes. That is the only way for me to get through. So now, and this was a lot of like time that I spent. It was actually last year when I finalized everything in 16, the process for actually my day-to-day management. So based off a lot of things out there, I think Elon Musk is, one person I've taken inspiration from, Benjamin Franklin, et cetera. I've got a morning routine. Every morning I wake up between 6 and 6:30. I make a black a cup of coffee, just and I drink black, shower, I read on my blogs. They're mainly tech, finance. Surprisingly, not food or beverage. So it kind of gives me something outside of this like wine and food world to think about because I really am passionate about tech and space, ironically. Anyway, so I read that in the morning because those are my goodies. That gets me out of bed. And then I go down, I jot down my list of things I need to do for the day. And so I'll make a list and I won't actually prioritize it at that moment. I'll just jot them down. I will respond to all my emails. This one I've been less diligent about in the last couple of weeks, but I'll respond to all my emails. That way everyone's guaranteed a response once in 24 hours. And then I'll meditate for about 10 or 15 minutes, which is pretty short. I wish it was longer. And then I'll start my day. And what I do now is I print out a list and I make a list, like a sheet. I physically put in the top 6 tasks that I need to do every day. And I schedule my day. So the first 4 hours of my day from basically 8 to 12, I'm in my home office and I'm getting things done. And that's Monday through Friday. And Monday, each day has a theme. So Monday is going to be management day. I need to focus on management processes, reviewing last week, touching base with the team, making sure that we have a good plan for the week. Tuesday, I'm focusing on products and operations. So for the winery, it's focusing on actually the wine that's in bottle or the grapes that are on the vine. For the restaurant, it's day-to-day operations, is making sure that we've got everything set for the week. Wednesday, I use for marketing, making sure that we've got everything figured out from like a social media standpoint, scheduling that, checking in on resources, whatever it might be, advertising results, whatever I need to review, PR stuff, that's a Wednesday task. On Thursday, I do sales. Sales could be, a lot of things, but I try to put these things in buckets, and Friday is like my catch-all for admin. But if I put things in buckets, that means on a weekly basis, I don't need to stress every single day about getting everything done. I can focus on what I need to based off of the theme for that day. And then I make that list. I make sure I get the right things in there. I tackle the first three hardest of the day. And the goal is finish everything by 12 o'clock so that when I, and this is like I said, the home office work. And then I have to work very efficiently in order to cover senses and Duchess, et cetera. And then I usually end up, depending on the day, I'll go to Duchess. So Tuesday through Thursday, I'm usually at Duchess. And that's when I check in with the team, you know, checking out, you know, inventory, management meetings, stuff like that. And then senses, I tend to do more on the Mondays and Fridays and Saturday and Sundays, because that's when there's travel, that's when there's events, that's when there's, you know, other stuff to do. Now, how much time does that leave me for my personal life? Well, you know, not so much. But the secret I have found is that I get to blend my personal life with the businesses. So for senses, of course, friends love to drink wine, right? So like a lot of events, I get to see friends, I get to make friends. Obviously, if I'm going out, like to restaurants or so on to sell wine, it's always great to go with friends. Of course, like I said, making new friends, the restaurant friends will come by. I'll get to organize meetings there, et cetera. You know, everyone loves food and beverage, which is a huge perk. And then, of course, like when I'm checking the vineyards and stuff like that, I'm actually visiting my family. They're in Occidental where the vineyards are. Everything's within about 5 minutes of there. So I get to see the family. I get to see all my friends from back home. I get to check in on accounts that sell our wine. You know, all these are great excuses for me to catch up with friends. So I get to combine the two lives, which is really a huge benefit. And then when I travel for senses, I'm almost always traveling somewhere where I have a couple friends and I get to catch up with them and learn a whole new city. Like it's pretty amazing. And I feel like it's a complete luxury. Now, I guess the only thing that really takes a hit probably is the dating life, because there's only so much time to date, but I have been better and better about that. I've squeezed in a couple of months. So, but I'm still single, and it probably makes sense because I've already got two girlfriends. One is a winery, one's a restaurant. So you have to be diligent. It's the only way to get through it all.
Yeah. So, I enjoyed knowing that you can blend your business and family life and get both done at the same time. So the next question is, what struggles did you have early on, or maybe still have now, for people who want to start a business but are working a full-time job? How can they manage that? And then also people who are starting a business and aren't making the kind of revenue that they need to make, so they're struggling firsthand. Can you talk to us about how you overcame struggles early on and possibly currently?
Absolutely. Good question. I think it's probably one of the hardest things as an entrepreneur, figuring out how the money adds up, right? Because it really doesn't. We've never taxed senses. We haven't taken from that company, you know, on a regular basis. It's everything gets reinvested, and that's really important because we can grow faster and so on. And, you know, we're looking at that terminal value, and the only way we were able to do that was by having a day job. And I think the trick is, if you're thinking about quitting a job or going into a situation where you don't have a sustainable source of income, you know, by basically becoming an entrepreneur without raising a ton of money, it's the best advice I ever heard was wait 1 year. Like, if you think you're ready now, wait 1 year, because it takes a long time to build a brand. And if you're going to jump right into it without having like that kind of plan in place or like proof of concept or people buying anything, you're going to be in a lot of pain. And if you're in pain personally, there's no way the business will survive. So I think we bootstrapped in senses, and we bootstrapped because we had day jobs, because wine was something you could do between the three of us that started it, that we could do on the side. We were able to do it in the nights. We were able to do it in the weekends. We were able to divide and conquer. Sometimes it got really time consuming, like when you're picking grapes, like we are right now. Or if, you know, you're in the middle of sales or whatever it might be, but you just have to make it work. And we did that realistically, we're still doing that. And you do it as long as you physically can. Just this year, we hired a CPA and a bookkeeper. Now that's crazy. Like, we should have probably done that a long time ago. But for us, it was always a philosophy, like, let's do it ourselves. Let's figure it out. Let's learn it. Let's talk to people. It saves us money and it saves us time. Well, not really. I guess it took our time, but it bought us time to keep building the business without taxing it financially too much. So I think the trick is, you just want to start the company or go all in on the company as late as possible, until you have to, kind of thing. Make it so successful that it's consuming so much of your time that you have to go all in. If you don't have the resources to pay yourself or to deplete the savings or whatever it might be, you really should consider the option of raising money. even if it's something as simple as $1,000 a month, whatever the heck it is, just to pay your basic expenses. Now, people probably need a little bit more than that. I lived at home for a couple of years. That was a huge, huge cost savings, and that's what kept us alive. Miles did the same thing for Census. You know, those are the sacrifices you make when you're starting a company. With Duchess, you know, it's a little different. We had to raise money. We're building this thing. We've got to, you know, we have a lot of employees. I do not have the luxury of basically people, you know, working for sweat equity. And that's, you know, that's hard because you need to have investment and you need to stay ahead of it. And what I've learned, I've come to terms with it over time, is like money is not something you can't control exactly what something costs and how much money you need in order to build the business. If you're building something sustainable, it's going to take investment and money to get there. So the trick is separating yourself and how you feel from the needs, from the financial needs of the company. It's not your responsibility if the company needs money. As long as you're doing the best possible job making the right decisions and not wasting money, then you just need to, you need to basically finance it somehow. And that's not a negative to you as a business owner. It's a reality. And it's better to be structured healthy as soon as possible, as soon as you need to, as soon as you need that income, as soon as your partners need that income, make it happen. Because if you start stressing on the personal side, the business will take a hit and eventually could lead to the downfall of the business. So it's pinching pennies in the beginning, using your savings, you know, offsetting whatever income needs you need for your personal life with a day job or even a part-time job if you can, as long as you physically can before raising money or living off of like the actual revenue from the company.
So you currently run a bootstrap business and a business that has an investor in it. So what would you say is the biggest difference in terms of the operations of running a bootstrap business versus a business that has investment?
There are many differences. The first and most important is the fact that the bootstrapped one, Census, I've got full authority and control on everything. And that is a pro in many ways. It's also a con because it means I have this luxury of doing things when I have time or when I want to. And I don't, you have to be religious about getting things done on a deadline. And this is something I've come to terms with over time. You know, you can't just wait and do your taxes or your accounting at like, you know, once a year. You know, you need to see this stuff more often, at least quarterly, but realistically monthly. And that's something I never really had to do, or we never had to do with Census, because, you know, sales have always grown significantly. We've always just had to account for sales and costs as we go into tax season. But the bootstrap company, it's like full authority, and you have to be really diligent about creating rules, processes, and deadlines for yourself. Otherwise, you potentially risk everything. Now, with investment, what's great is you actually have like a team. You have an investor who has requirements, who wants reports, who expects this. Like, that's fantastic. I love it. It's nice to have, you know, every 2 weeks or once, you know, a month, depending on the time period, a report of all the details that are going on, the operations, a summary of the financials, you know, what's going on the next month. You know, all those kind of oddball thoughts are all basically, you know, released into some sort of document or communication. And that's fantastic because it keeps everything in line. Also at the same time, it means there's more stress. You have to, you know, keep in mind, like, hey, there's not like unlimited funds, you know, waiting for you to do whatever you want. Like, you have to justify every single thing, and you have to show like there's a budget for this, is what we expect, this is what's going to happen, and report on it. And the, it's good though. It's good to have that oversight. And I think we're very lucky with Census to have come where we are now without that oversight. But it's always been something in the back of my head, like, hey, it'd be great to have a board of advisors that we could report to, et cetera, because, you know, at the end of the day, like, you'll hold yourself accountable for everything, but there's so many things to prioritize that you have to be so diligent that it's, you're bound to make a mistake and to get behind on something at some point. And playing catch up is one of the hardest things ever. You don't want to be in that position. So both of them have their pros and some of their cons too.
Can you talk about one of the biggest mistakes you've made in your business journey and what you learned from it?
Biggest mistake. That's a hard one. Always, it's just, I'd say probably one of my my biggest mistakes, or I guess my biggest learning opportunities, has been the ability to get to offload my responsibilities. So it's that whole perfectionist mindset. You want to get things done perfectly, but you can't always do that. You don't have the time. Your founder, your time is so valuable. And I think my example about hiring a CPA, like, and a bookkeeper, like, that should have been done probably 2 years ago, or at least last year. But that's okay. I mean, the bookkeeper is making up for it and putting everything in line for last year. But buying myself that time gives me the opportunity to take care of the big picture. You know, I am completely in tune with what's going on with the product, marketing, sales, you know, and the business. And the more that I can keep the big picture and looking ahead, the more successful Census is going to be. Same with Duchess. And same thing with Duchess. We, you know, we just hired a bookkeeper and all these other, you know, really cool things to save me time. Because if I was trying to do the bookkeeping and the accounting and the payables and making sure everything was okay, it's stressful and it's overwhelming. So I think being cognizant of how valuable your time is and trying to maximize the amount of time that you have to think of the big picture of the business, that's a good, it's a big challenge. And I think it was my biggest learning opportunity starting these two companies.
And how has working with co-founders been? One company has two co-founders, other has one co-founder. Do you feel you could have started the business as a solopreneur? And do you think it's important to have co-founders?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the person or like the idea. I do think that over time, I'm learning more and more and I'm becoming more and more confident in my ability to be a solo entrepreneur. I think there was a huge benefit starting my first company with two co-founders. It brought balance to the team. It brought another opinion. For example, Max and I have different opinions on many different things, but we can talk it out and eventually we'll come to agreement on whatever it is. He'll make sacrifices, I'll make sacrifices. Miles will provide great input in regards to, you know, being a swing vote or kind of adding different perspective. So three of us, surprisingly, always end up on the same page once we're done discussing things. And I think that has a lot of value, in addition to the fact that, you know, each of them brings something different to the table. And we all kind of provide that input and can become like relative experts in those areas. With Duchess, it's the same thing. Like, we, Carolyn and I sought out to start this project with Carolyn being kind of the heart and the energy and like the day-to-day operations and the persona of the restaurant. I was going to be the guy that kind of just, you know, brought everything together and made this thing operate. And that was a good balance. She always joked and said, you know, I was the brains and she was the heart of the project. And like, I always thought it was silly, but I get it. And it's a healthy balance. And I think eventually, like, moving forward, like, I'm getting to that point where I can just start something on my own and know exactly, not exactly, because you never know everything, but I at least know, I will know what I don't know. And I can ask for that help, whether it's through a board of advisors, whether it's hiring employees, or whether it's consultants. Like, I know now a lot more than I did 7 years ago. And that's got a lot of value. So I think it's worth having co-founders in the beginning of an entrepreneurial career, because there's so much to learn from working with each other. The challenge is making sure that all the communication you have is as clear and direct as possible. Do not leave unknowns, because if you leave unknowns, there's always going to be an issue down the road. And I don't think I would change anything about how I started these companies.
And what have you learned in terms of systematizing your business or building systems to maybe, or automation in your business?
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest areas, and it goes back to just the use of my time. The more systems and processes that you put in place, the better the more efficient the company will run. So for example, I'm realizing more and more that like some of these processes that I've put into place are semi-redundant. With bookkeeping, once again, being the primary example, the only reason I keep bringing this up is because I've been head deep in bookkeeping for the last like month and a half as we file taxes and get everything caught up. But, you know, I had spreadsheets to handle certain parts of payables or receivables that, you know, partially made their way into QuickBooks for accounting. And, you know, you just don't have to have multiple sources of the same info. Same thing with sales tracking. Like, I've got spreadsheets for this, I've got a spreadsheet for that, and then, you know, something in QuickBooks. Like, you have to put in processes that are as efficient as can be. And I think starting from scratch, it was hard. We had to make all of these things up as we went with Census. I'm still making them up as we go with Duchess. And it's my number one priority right now is to review all the processes I put in place at Duchess with the team and then add whatever's missing. Because I still feel like we're missing a couple of things. And what separates a successful company that can scale and grow absent of like the founder's day-to-day like involvement and day-to-day like contribution is management. And management comes down to processes and enabling an executive team to run the show. And that's been the most humbling experience, is learning how to let go while still also knowing and keeping a pulse on everything that goes on. So I've been diligent about putting things into place for Census. I've been working on it very hard with Duchess. I'm still catching up with things, but this is where like the overwhelming feeling from managing the books or whatever, or trying to do something that you're not, you know, exactly capable of doing, or that you're not, it's not the best use of your time. Getting rid of those tasks so you can focus on the things that you need to focus on is integral to the success of any company. And that's been my lesson.
Earlier, you mentioned that you had to learn as you go, and you're going into a business where you may not have had any experience in. So where do you learn to have success? How did you know that you're supposed to do certain things to start a restaurant? How did you know that there's X, Y, and Z to build a winery? Like, where do you go to learn success?
Another great question. So I think it's just talking to people. The winery, the first thing I did was I signed up to work Harvest. That was hands down the only way to really start in the industry. So I plugged myself immediately into the community and develop credibility. I was willing to work those long hours to make wine, et cetera. And so that created opportunities to go to tasting rooms. I did competitive research. I bought wine. I tasted wine. I talked to people. I compiled all this information. I took extensive notes. I have all my notes. I had yellow pads of paper that I would go through on a daily basis. And now I've gone to Moleskines. But I have all my notes since the beginning of time for starting Census and Duchess, which I think is going to be hilarious to reference back to one day. But I was diligent, and that's what kind of created it conceptualized what I was thinking and what we wanted to be. And over time, you know, we've constantly evolved. We've been super flexible in what we are as a brand, Senses and Duchess. And I think it's the ability to evolve and to respond to what you discover in the market or from consumers is like the secret to creating a sustainable brand and something that can build on its own. And I think that's probably the biggest area to focus on.
In the meantime, you mentioned journaling. So, I mean, note-taking. Are these on-the-spot note-taking, or are you spending time journaling every night or every morning to document your thoughts?
It's a good question. I think most of my journaling, I may do a little bit in the morning. It's a quick just jotting things down. At the end of the month, I also reflect. But those are more at a personal level, Javier. But I think for the business, all those notes I take during the moments or in transit or when I'm planning my week. Those are when I make notes. And then on a weekly basis, I go back and I cross off the items. So my to-do list, if you will, I capture stuff on a weekly basis on that notepad or in that notebook. And I get to reflect on that, you know, at the end of the week. And on my daily basis, I go through my daily task. And that means I've never left a rock unturned. And that's how I've been able to keep up, you know, with whatever has to be done. And like I said, sometimes there's a lot more I do and other times there's a lot less. I just have to have that paper to keep track of it all.
Where do you learn your success when you're learning on the go and you don't know?
Yeah, well, it was literally asking and talking to every single person that could. So that was going through my alumni network at Harvey Mudd, my alumni network at CMC, my contacts from working at Jackson Family Wines, all the contacts I made while working other jobs, all the just job experience I had, compiling all of that into one place and just sharing it with the team, discussing it, and then kind of applying it as we went on constantly, almost on a daily basis, at least a weekly basis. I learned something new and then I added to my workflow. That's how I was able to start the companies and that's how I was able to grow them and identify what we really needed to focus on. And of course, that network's always there to help you when when you have a question.
Yeah, you said you went to your network, and earlier in the conversation, you mentioned the idea of not liking the term networking. So, how do you see networking?
I see it as making friends. I know it sounds crazy, but I don't look at networking as networking. And I think there are times and places where there's a lot of networking happening. I don't know. I just it never it, it doesn't feel authentic to me. And I get it, like people want to help others, people want to help themselves. But I don't take that approach of like, I have something, like what do you have to trade me kind of thing. I take the approach, I would love to help you. And if you're a good person, I'm gonna help you. And if you want to help me, great. I'll ask you the questions, or I'll get a sense of like perhaps where I can ask you something. Maybe it's today, maybe it's a year from now, maybe it's 20 years from now. And I think having that like as a reference is huge. And if you're going at it as making friends, like I love meeting people and making friends, like that is life. If you're not making friends and valuing the relationships that you develop, what's the point of having a ton of money? What's the point of overcoming challenges and building businesses? Like, I think life is measured in the strength of those relationships and the way that you spend time with people. So when I approach people like that, I just feel like there's no baggage, there's no hidden agenda. And it's a healthy way of just getting to know a lot of people and then having the ability to call on them when I have a question.
And so, thank you for sharing that. So, I want to go into your early history. You mentioned as part of your story as a kid, you liked being outdoors and you liked nature and astronomy. So, early on, what did you want to become as a kid?
I always think about what exactly I wanted to be, and I don't know. I know I'm trying to think of like a show and tell in first grade, and everyone had the fireman or this or that, and I was probably thinking about space back then. I've always wanted to travel the universe. I think it was a lot of my sci-fi books. Ender's Game, I think I read that like third or fourth grade. That book changed like everything about my life, and all I could think about was how the heck do I get to outer space, travel the universe, and explore it. And I think everything I've done since then, in a really, it sounds weird, but like everything I've done ever since then has been in that effort. And I thought being an astronaut would be really cool. But I think over time I realized, okay, I don't want to just go to space to do, just spacewalks and so on, or just go to the moon. I'd love to leave this solar system, leave this galaxy, and travel all across the universe to explore things. So I guess an explorer, if you will.
And so then you ended up attending college at Harvey Mudd College in Claremont, California, which is a math, science, technology, engineering school. You said you made that decision kind of at the last minute. You were considering other colleges. So if you were to reflect back on that experience, what do you feel was the biggest takeaway that you've learned from attending a STEM college?
Yeah, I think it was one of the best decisions that I didn't. It's not that I didn't make, but that I luckily made. It's just fate, if you will. Biggest takeaway is, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of hard work that happened at Harvey Mudd, and knowing that I was average was a very humbling perspective. You come out of high school and gain good grades and excelling in so many different areas, and you think you're on top of the world. And getting to Harvey Mudd, I learned very quickly I was just a normal guy that, sure knew how to study and do well on tests, but that did not mean I was the smartest guy in the room. And that was an important lesson, number one. Number two, it reinforced the idea of relationships. I know it sounds crazy, but I already valued friendships incredibly before Harvey Mudd. But going to Harvey Mudd, I think, is when I was able to combine friendships and, work as like as a true symbiotic thing, and being able to know all these cool people who were doing such cool things. And to reflect back on that experience 10 years ago or whenever it was, and knowing that I'm still friends with a majority of those people, and I still can reach out to them any day of the week, and they are very likely to respond and help me however they can. So the strength of those relationships, and just knowing that I can help them and they can help me. But also knowing that the mission that we all went to Harvey Mudd to learn was to make the world a better place. I know it sounds so cliche, but it was one of those things that I already knew deep within, but now I really know that's what I care about. I care about how this planet is treated. I care about making the world safer and healthier for the next generation. I care about leaving this planet so we can become a multiplanetary species. Like, these are things that I reflected on at Mudd, and then I also was able to really focus on like my future. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to be besides the fact that I love science. I've been able to realize it's not just science for the sake of science. Like, I could do something entrepreneurially or business as a business owner, but still be involved with science. And that was, I didn't technically really learn that Harvey Mudd. I learned that one through CMC and through working with Jess Jackson as a mentor, but that all shaped who I am today. And I've never looked back. Sorry about that.
Yeah, it's okay. So yeah, you mentioned after you went to Claremont McKenna College and you got a master's degree in finance, what was the takeaway from that degree?
I think Claremont McKenna had a completely different perspective on careers and future. They're a lot more government, political science, and economic driven. And the first thing I did when I went to Claremont was reach out to 40 or 50 alumni to network, literally to network in finance and kind of figure out job opportunities and what I wanted to do. And that was forced. That was forced on us as like a before school started. And I was like, oh my God, like, this is crazy. And it was so out of my like comfort zone that like it took a while to adjust to. But I learned through CMC that, you know what, like, it's not just networking for the sake of networking. Like, I'm asking for help through a group that I have a commonality with. Like, we all went to CMC. They're all alumni. And they are more than willing to give back, you know, when they can. Sure, they don't have a ton of time to talk to us. Who cares? Even 30 minutes on a phone call or even 10 minutes made a difference. And I religiously took notes on this once again. And it kind of went into my thought process as far as what I wanted to do next. But CMC gave me a professional, career-driven perspective that I didn't get at Mudd. At Mudd, I got, you know, like the sciences, the academics, the rigor, the relationships. But then CMC, I was able to get a little professional component that I was able to morph with Harvey Mudd. And having, you know, the two of those together, I think completely built the way that I approach life and the way that I approach business. And the spreadsheets that I learned, ironically, while working at the winery when I was an intern at Harvey Mudd or at Jackson Family Wines while studying at Harvey Mudd, those skills put me far ahead of the curve when I went to CMC to do financial spreadsheets. And learning the bare bones about business and accounting and this and that and game theory, that all has come together to where I am today from a strategy standpoint and execution standpoint.
So what books or people have inspired you? Earlier you mentioned, I think, The Curve. I forgot something about The Curve. And then
not The Curve. Now I'm blanking on it. Oh, come to me.
Okay, and then the person you mentioned, Jess Jackson. But have other books or people inspired you?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So it was Crossing the Chasm. That was the book. And I don't know if I'd say it inspired me. It just kind of it showed an idea that was applicable. I mean, there's a laundry list of books. Some of them are worth more than others. But it's going to sound really silly, but my favorite books to read are sci-fi books. And I've in the last year or two, I've read really cool books like Dune, Foundation series by Isaac Asimov. I haven't reread Ender's Game, but I'm thinking about it. And these are books that just get me dreaming. And they're incredibly exciting. And I just love that because I'm a dreamer. I think that's what keeps me going on a daily basis. Today's Sunday. I woke up at 6 o'clock this morning to work on, you know, bookkeeping and taxes just so I could finish before this call. And, you know, what's going to get you out of bed at 6 o'clock on a Sunday on your free day to do work like that? Well, I'll tell you, it's because I'm so excited about the future and where I'm going. And it's because of like books like that that keep me going. There's a lot of professional books and inspiration. I think Jess Jackson deserves probably a majority of the credit because he opened my eyes to the business world. Right after him, it was Len Kearney, who used to be the CEO of Jackson Family Wines. That guy has been, you know, both of these were like second dads to me. They both took me under their wing and showed me so many things that like I would have never had perspective on before. And it really proves the value of a mentor. Mentors are incredible. And I think right now it's, I'm at a point where I don't have one and I need to find one, because they're a sounding board and they can inspire you and give you so much more than what you expect. And obviously they enjoy helping others. So I think those are really important. Of course, you know, I've already mentioned Elon Musk once, but you know, I don't know the guy, but I love what he's done. And I love what SpaceX is doing and, you know, what Tesla's doing and, you know, what his vision is of like the future and AI. Like, I think it's so exciting to materialize and bring all these pieces together, whether it's science, whether it's space, whether it's, you know, like I said, computer science, you know, for AI, bring these things together to make the world a better place. Like, that is so cool. And, you know, the ability to execute. So I think, you know, Bezos at Amazon is someone I look at and read a lot about. Warren Buffett, I look at a lot of his stuff constantly. Musk, those are probably the three. You know, I'm always curious about Steve Jobs. I don't ever heard the best things about him as a person, but what he's been able to do is impressive, and his focus on product. These are all really important lessons that I feel like you can only learn by observing or by doing, but we don't have that luxury of time. So, and of course, there's a lot of business books that I read too, but I don't know them on the top of my head.
And early on, I mentioned that you're interested in alternative energy, technology, and space. So what do you see yourself doing in the future in those areas?
Oh, yeah, I'm a dreamer, so I want to do it all. But I think right now I look at Senses as the ability to learn about marketing, to build a business from scratch that gives credibility to what I'm doing in the professional world. That's going to continue on and eventually become, you know, either an annuity or, you know, from an exit strategy standpoint, perhaps it gets acquired. I don't know. That's a really hard decision to make right now. Duchess, you know, is a retail side of the business, and I'm learning how to manage an investor, and their expectations, how to manage a team and, you know, the moving parts there. That all this experience gets folded into, you know, my mindset. You know, what's next? Like, I really would love to dabble in technology. I'd love to help people manage their relationships better. Going back to how I look at relationships, they're all friendships. So what if there was a way to better catalog your relationships, your friendships, and to help like nudge you when you lose touch with people? Like, there, sure, society, or there's research, psychological research done that you can only have 150, you know, relationships. But what if with the tools today, whether it's social media, phone, etc., like, what if you can have more relationships? I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, why not help? And so I see an opportunity to help people with technology for that purpose. And who knows, I could morph into a million different things. And then, you know, I need to break through from a capital standpoint. My goal is to be independent of the system. So I don't have to lean on investors. I don't have to worry about this or that. The whole worry and fear mindset is not productive. And I've done a really good job of, you know, removing the fear component, but I still have financial stress. And as a business owner, I internalize a lot of things. So being independent of those systems would be an accomplishment. So if I can do that, whether it's selling a business or being acquired or creating an annuity, that is a dream, because then I can pursue what I love, which is coaching others, helping others, maybe investing in others, mentoring others, and eventually looking at alternative energy in space. I'd love to do something. I've always wanted to do something in solar and really kind of address the way that we use electricity. I think there's a lot of work already being done. You know, it's going to change by the time I get into it. So who knows what it will actually be. But water and electricity and solar, those are like, I say water and solar are the two things that I care about the most. And then space, it's exploration. It's just traveling. I don't know if that involves building rockets or if it's more kind of volunteering for things and working with others to execute. I love to execute. I love to make things efficient, and I love people. And I think you combine all that stuff together, it creates a lot of opportunity for the future businesses.
Yeah. And looking back, what are you most proud of from running your own business? What do you feel is the biggest accomplishment you've made?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, surviving is obviously a very, very, very proud accomplishment. Honestly, I think with Census, it's how quickly we've grown. I mean, we've known for the last couple of years that our mission now is to become one of the top 10 Pinot Noir and Chardonnay producers, and we are well on that path. And to do that in less than 6 years of operating and really only less than 3 years of being in the marketplace, that's insane. And, you know, there's a lot more to do, but I'm very proud of that. With Dutchess, it's the fact that we've created a really beautiful place that people have really enjoyed coming to and have wanted to come back to and then tell their friends about it. And just the fact that I've been able to do this and juggle a full-time job all the way up to opening Dutchess and being able to manage the two projects together, it's so humbling and it's been an amazing experience. But I think the most important thing, and I think the most important thing that I'm proud of, is being able to still have my personal life with my professional life. I'm happy because it's not work. I love it and I love what I do. And because of that, like, it rubs off on people and I get to see my friends and I get to make friends. And if I didn't have that, we probably wouldn't be sitting here talking today.
And so what advice would you give to your younger self, knowing what you know now? What advice would you give to yourself back then, if you're just starting out?
I think the biggest advice to younger me would be the ability to let go. I think, you know, realizing that you don't have to have control or manage every single process is a lesson that I've slowly learned. And it's just something I think that comes with growing up, in my opinion. But being able to let go of things that do not matter in your current state, whether it's a personal life or whether it's professionally, like, you have to keep moving and you have to look at today and moving forward. The past is the past and you can learn from it, but you can't change it. So there's no reason to waste and spend all this energy reflecting on it if it's not going to create, you know, a more productive future. And I could have probably used that advice, you know, a long time ago, but that's okay. You live and learn.
And what would make being on this show a success for you, and a success for the people listening to it right now?
I think the best thing is just, well, I mean, there are many different things. I'd say the best thing is if you live in the East Bay or in Oakland or the Bay Area, come check out Dutchess, right? Because that's it's a cool restaurant. You can see the results of a lot of my work. But for me, it's just being able to share the story and helping others learn from the story, and being available. If you ever want to reach out to me, you can email me. It's all, you put on the notes or whatever. But my handle's cstreeter at cstreeter, C-S-T-R-I-E-T-E-R. Reach out to me on social media, email me. I'm just happy to be a resource for people and to help wherever I can. And I hope people can learn from what I've gone through. And I haven't learned everything and I'll never know everything. But the fact that I can continue to learn and share the story, that's really fulfilling to me. So that makes it a success. Just sharing the story is a success. And so I appreciate you taking the time to set this up.
And so the best place is C Streeter. Is there any email or any other social media handle?
cstreeter@gmail.com. But everything's at cstreeter. My website is chrisstreeter.com or cstreeter.com. Everything is pretty easy to find if you type in my name. So I've made sure to make that easy.
And so if there's one last message that you want people to remember about your story, your mission, or your message, what would that be?
I really think the biggest thing is just to do what you love. And if you love something and you work really hard at it, everything else will come together, especially if you have that mindset. And I think if you're in a situation that you're not happy about and you're kicking yourself on a daily basis, then stop, you know, and look at what's next. And of course, you know, going back to my original advice, if it provides income, keep the income while you get your other thing going. But there's no reason to do something you don't love. And the sooner that you make that decision and that commitment to yourself, the sooner you'll be happier and those around you will be happier, and it'll change your life.
All right. Thank you. And of course. And the mission of the Javier Morquecho Show is to create a community around learning how to start, grow, and scale your business. Once again, this is Chris Streeter. He's an entrepreneur from Sonoma County, a co-founder and owner of Senses Wines. And it's one of the most exciting wineries coming out of Sonoma. He's also the co-founder and owner of Dutchess Oakland. It's a popular Rock Ridge restaurant, and it's a hotbed for youthful industry talent. And so you should go check it out if you are in that East Bay area. And not to stop there, you've learned about his early dreams of being an explorer, as well as his future plans working towards technology, alternative energy, and space. So in this episode, I hope you had a chance to learn about his experience, and I hope you're inspired from hearing his story and take action. Reach out to him if you have any further questions. And also, if you enjoyed this conversation, have ideas for future episodes, or if you want to reach out to me, I'm also available by email at javier@javiermorquecho.com. Once again, it's javier@javiermorquecho.com. I'm also here to continue the conversation and want to discuss topics that are important to you. So thank you, Chris, for being here, and thank you, everyone, for being a part of the show. See you all next time.
Awesome.
Dreams, some things came to never end.